Welcome to podtech.net. We're here for a podcast of the Always On Conference with Denise Howell with Bag and Baggage, IT Conversation, Sound Policy for Lawyers. Welcome to the podcast.
Pleasure to be here.
Well, we're just swapping podcasts. You just did a podcast with me. I'm doing a podcast with you. What's up these days? And I'd like to chat with you about kind of what's going on in the policy world. Obviously, we were chatting about net neutrality, which we've had a lot of stories on podtech.net. And a lot of people are confused out there on really what this is. And a lot of fireworks and confusion, but it's really one of the most important issues that's facing America in terms of the long-term, medium long-term plan, which is, you know, markets for, you know, entrepreneurs and wealth creation to education to kind of global competitiveness. What's going on with net neutrality?
That's a really, really hard question to answer because there has been more procedural jockeying in Washington over that issue in the last 2 months than just about any other political hot button.
Well, the internet's
issue
a bunch of tubes, not a big truck, right? I mean, that's what Senator Stevens said.
That's right.
It's a series of tubes, not a big truck. Boy, that's really someone who has a command of the issues.
It's unfortunately not atypical of how legislators, especially those who are getting their educations on the issues from lobbyists, are brought up to speed about these things. But it is, as you say, an important issue. You guys have done tons of coverage on this that I'm sure I can't add much to, only to clarify that it is a question of how things are enabled to move through those tubes, to use Senator Stevens' metaphor, and what kind of pricing is going to be involved. I mean, traditionally, there has not been any kind of distinction between one kind of bit and another traveling over the network. And some of the providers have looked at recent trends on the web and seen that certain kinds of information are more bandwidth intensive than others, and they've concluded that perhaps there should be a higher cost involved in the companies that are surviving on making that information available. So there's been a lot of back and forth about whether neutrality is going to prevail and what sort of legislation is going to be passed and where the provisions are going to appear, maybe tagged on to other bills that have little to do with the actual issue, maybe in a bill that actually addresses the issue head on. We don't know what's going to happen with that yet.
Is it an education issue? Is it really, is there any, obviously, is there lobbying going on? Obviously, the telcos and the service providers have an interest, bandwidth intensive to their business. They're the ones providing it. Or is it just lack of education or both?
I think it's lack of education. I think that if the person on the street who is either a business user of the web or a personal user of the web or some combination thereof, as most of us are these days, if they were aware of the question that, you know, in addition to the pretty considerable access fees they're already paying, they might well be the victims of additional pass-through costs because their service providers are going to be hit with those costs, then there would be a larger hue and cry than we see.
So as Ronald Reagan once said, it's a trickle-down effect.
Exactly.
You know, more costs imposed, more regulations, but it's a dynamic environment, so it's like a moving train. It's hard to hit what mm-hmm. that is. So, you know, sometimes the best move is not to move, mm-hmm. right? I mean, in this case.
Right. I don't know about you, but I have both cable for television access at home and pay for DSL. And, you know, the tally of those two bills every month is considerable. Our cable bill is something like $150 a month, and we're not even getting internet access with that. So when you consider that that's just the price to get on the network, and then once you're on the network, you might be hit with additional costs because of things that now Google has to shoulder the burden of, or PodTech, just to get at those kinds of offerings.
So gasoline hit $4 a gallon here in California. And, you know, I was speaking with someone, and we're doing a lot of environmental energy podcasts, and we're going to be doing some programming around that. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, the internet actually enables people not to commute. I mean, people are working at home. So in a way, let's increase the price of telecommuting, if you will, mm-hmm. and using the internet, wouldn't it make sense to like incent people to use electronic communications rather than driving around?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that the flip side could be made, the flip argument could be made is that if people are becoming more reliant on the web and using that as their cost savings method for gas, that maybe that could be made up by the telcos. I'm sure they probably view it that way.
Well, they're not in the gas business, so they don't really care. So, I mean, I guess that shows you where they stand. But, right. You know, it just doesn't make any sense to me. Well, you know, I think people should just, who are listening, just get involved and just educate people about what net neutrality is and you know, understand that increased cost on bandwidth is only going to trickle down as more cost to everyone else, when in fact there should be a Moore's Law for bandwidth. So it actually should be going the other direction, mm-hmm. not being regulated and taxed.
Absolutely. And the more people can let their legislators know that that's the way they feel about it.
It's funny. The Republicans should be for net neutrality because they're anti-tax.
And anti-regulation.
Anti-regulation. But that's not what's happening, is it?
No, it's not. And you know, you have to consider who their largest campaign contributors are and how that's influencing their decisions.
Well, and as Robert Scoble would say, a naked conversation needs to be had with the Republicans and saying, guys, this is completely against what you stand for, and Rush Limbaugh should be all over this to tell his Republican guys this is not what the Republicans stand for, fundamentally.
And Rush, in particular, as a podcaster,
I think he charges for podcasting.
That's
though,
true.
So, yeah, he's got his franchise. I think it's a token podcast, you know, a little tidbit, and charges the premium, but... Yes, it doesn't make any sense. So let's talk about another topic that is around the legal net area, and that's Creative Commons. We're talking about people like myself who offer their material out there for free. Mm-hmm. What is Creative Commons offering these days? And there's a lot of different flavors of it. I mean, I'm afraid of the whole open source licensing thing where, you know, open source licensing is going through a change as well. I mean, the GPL and dual source licenses are changing with managed service. So there's all kinds of loopholes and kind of cottage industries baking out because of it. Is that same kind of thing going to happen with Creative Commons? And what is Larry and the legal brain trust in the community talking about?
I think if people are waiting for Creative Commons licenses to come up in litigation settings and get tested and applied and enforced and construed, very, very little of that has happened. Creative Commons is just a few years old. You're right, they have sort of a whole variety of licenses that are available. And that some are tailored toward audio and music and multimedia type experiences, and some are more tailored toward text. And all of them allow you to select as the licensor whether you're going to permit commercial use of the material or not. And I think that is probably the biggest hot button issue that we'll see come up in courts.
So where people aren't actually stating it's Creative Commons, the implication or the implied law is what? What is the exposure or downside, upside, if any?
If you're not actually applying a license to your work, by default you retain all the rights. So that is a fairly straightforward equation right there until you throw RSS and syndication into the mix. And there's been quite a bit of discussion and no law whatsoever yet on...
This is wild, wild west all over again.
Yes, on the impact of syndicating material via RSS. And one of the schools of thought on that is that there might be some sort of limited implied license involved. I think if a court were to hold that simply by virtue of syndicating, you're actually authorizing some uses that would not be contemplated if all your copyrights were reserved, that it would be very limited and that commercial use would probably not fall within what's included there. But we just don't know. We're kind of all biding our time and waiting to see. There was... one little blip on the radar screen when Adam Curry had some Flickr photos that were licensed for non-commercial use, picked up by a publication in the Netherlands that is obviously a commercial publication and used without permission.
So they were Adam's photos?
They were Adam's photos, just family photos posted to Flickr. And because of who Adam and Patricia are and the fact that they're well-known and well-followed in an Entertainment Tonight kind of way in Holland, those pictures were of interest to this tabloid. And there were a number of issues involved, as I understand it. They also printed information about their daughter's school that probably had no business being made public. But as far as the photo issue went, it seemed like the judge got it and vindicated the fact that, you know, if you...
So they ruled in favor of Adam.
Yes. So there is that limited and non-U.S. precedent at this point. And, you know, I'm sure the folks at Creative Commons, which are now global and offering their services in various countries and tailoring to the laws of those jurisdictions, I'm sure they're happy to have had at least one court look at the license and go, yep, we're going to enforce this in the way that it is worded.
And right now in our community, really, it's community policed. I mean, people, it's a etiquette thing at this point. But soon that's going to, as more and more people and more competition comes in, someone's going to hit that tripwire.
That's right. And you know, I mean, there's, when you're talking about a global community, the notion of community diffuses somewhat. And I think that there is probably from the creator side an acknowledgement that non-commercial use that is consistent with the fair use doctrine that's already part of our copyright laws is something that they'd be perfectly happy to allow and enjoy the benefits of. You know, if they're getting their name and their work out there, as long as somebody is not building a business on top of it that they themselves could be taking advantage of, they're probably fairly happy with the situation. But it's when, you know, in the blogging world, we've seen a lot of wholesale adoption of people's content and repackaging without attribution and without linking back and without permission and for commercial purposes, you know, putting AdWords on there and things like that. And, you know, I think more and more people are going to jump down the throats of folks that are trying to take advantage of the beneficial motives of Creative Commons.
So basically your advice at this point, from what I'm hearing you say, is that if people want their content to be shared and used freely, just issue a Creative Commons license. If not, don't.
I think that's a good way to look at it, yeah. I mean, when you're talking about open source licenses, you're really getting into more of the software arena anyway, and Creative Commons was specifically designed not to address those problems, but really to address the creations of average people with technology that you can buy in your local Best Buy or Fry's. And so it's a good fit for that kind of material.
We're in a world now that's constantly changing, and you know, you've been in the middle of the action, you know, from a legal and also policy perspective for the past many years, and there's certainly a lot going on right now. What's your view on the landscape and over the next 5 years in terms of where we are now and kind of where we're going, and what do you see as kind of threshold issues for just accelerating great change and utility for users? And obviously we're pro media, and obviously, you know, getting information out there on a global scale. What are the things you see out there coming up?
I see courts and legislatures really having to grapple with the fact that copyright law as it exists on the books today is out of sync with the behaviors and desires of people using media and producing media. The fact that Creative Commons even exists is an artifact of that. Creative Commons is a route around for the copyright laws. It's a nice one. It's a systematic route around that is available to lots of people, but there's no getting around the fact that it is end running the broad nature of our copyright laws. And where that is a problem from a policy standpoint is that technology just runs right ahead of where the law is and is going to go in the conceivable future. I like to think of it as the Sammy Hagar problem. You know, like, why should I drive 55? Because there are
that was
no
their only good song, by the way. You know, Van Halen was great, and then Sammy was okay, but that was the best song.
That's right. So, I mean, there are no speed limits when copyright infringement is as easy as cut, paste, publish.
So shouldn't it just be simpler? Shouldn't it just be, I mean, I'm not a lawyer, so maybe I'm just kind of, you know, hand-waving how simple this is, but shouldn't it be just be that if you don't put copyright on your site, then it defaults to Creative Commons? Wouldn't that be a better solution?
Something like that is a very creative way of looking at it, but that's not the way the courts and lawmakers have ever approached it. But it's something that you know, we might be moving toward down the road, some sort of solution.
Well, how did Creative Commons exist? Was it written into law?
No, it's not a law.
It's just a license.
It's a license. It's a contract, which exists because the overarching framework of copyright law is that everything is tightly controlled and all rights are reserved unless you expressly say otherwise. Creative Commons is just an easy way to say otherwise.
So it might make sense then for people who are developing content to be a little bit more proactive with Creative Commons to help shape that license to accelerate remixing and whatnot, right?
Very much so, yeah. And the more that those, what I see really happening is kind of a two-tiered ecosystem of media in the next 5 to 10 years, because I think there will be a lot of traction around Creative Commons licenses. You've just told me in the interview we were doing a second ago before we switched mics that your company uses them for the material that it's distributing.
No, we don't use Creative Commons.
Oh, well.
I'm defaulting to copyright, which I guess I don't think we actually put copyright on our site. I have to
right,
check.
No, you don't have to. You don't have to even give a notice in order for material to be copyrighted. It is by default.
So I guess I got a claim on anyone who makes money off PodTech.
You do. You do indeed.
But I just, you know, it's so we should. So yeah, we have to look into that. Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
Not a lot of content developers are aware of that. I mean, they are. I mean, know it's out there, but how can they get more involved? What is Creative Commons doing? Any outreach at all? I know it's all volunteer based, and there's a lot of people involved. But how do people get involved, and what are they doing to?
Well, there's a lot of information available at the Creative Commons site. If you go to creativecommons.org, they have a blog. They have all kinds of case studies and people that they've highlighted as creative commoners, people who are using the licenses in very productive ways to get their material out there and more widely distributed. But I think where we're going to see this go is that more and more people, as more and more people adopt these licenses and their works are more easy to access and use and remix and build upon creatively, that those works will be the preferred ones that users will seek out, and that things that are more tightly and traditionally governed by copyright law will fall a bit back.
It's kind of like the walled garden versus the walled garden search engines versus the open consuming, like Google, for example.
I mean, exactly.
The new stuff always wins out because that's what users are expecting.
Mm-hmm. And it's more flexible. I think that's the key, that users are demanding things to be easy and accessible and usable. And, you know, they're expecting them to make sense with the capabilities of the technology that they're using. And if they don't, there's a bit of a disconnect mentally and a resentment on the user's part. And as that resentment continues to bubble along, I think, you know, the economic ramifications of that are going to be pretty clear.
We're here at Always On with Denise Howell talking about just net issues and legal issues, net neutrality and Creative Commons, two big issues in the acceleration of this new culture. Thanks so much for the podcast.
Thank you so much, Sean.